show do you do?
It's called Polycast.
On the internet, is it?
I know everybody's name, and I know everybody's voice from listening to the previous shows.
You don't listen to the shows?
You wait, what?
Ian, you better get going with the introductions here. You're holding us up. What's going on?
Welcome to Polycast 20. I am Ian Hodges, also known as Oz, A-A-H-Z on the forums. I'm, of course, joined by Dan. Say hi, Dan.
Hello.
And I'm also here with the returning Imran Siddiqui.
I'm not here.
Mackie is, of course, joining us.
I'm still asleep. It helps if I plug in the listen part of my headphones.
What's going on? I can't hear anyone.
She's talking to her suitors.
No.
And Locatus, or Wouter Schneiders, is here as well.
Yes, I'm here.
Wow, he actually got the pronunciation right in the first try.
Not really.
Put some practice.
It doesn't matter. I got the pronunciation right in Imran's world.
Holy crap, he does listen to earlier episodes.
Don't panic, Dan.
We have quite a bit of topics today for the show. We'll have interesting modcast topics. I participated in some of these threads. Yay for me.
Yes, yeah, so you'll be leading us in those discussions. Good for you.
You're the only one who's read them.
Yeah. And we have somebody else's strategies, and I will partake in the Senate and let you know how I have won on several occasions, different ways than what I've heard on Polycast, so that will be interesting.
What's winning? What?
No, well, winning. What we tell actually works.
I played a little bit of a game the other night. I was impressed with myself.
Playing on pre-settler.
No, I'm playing on pre-settler.
Oh.
A lot of Beyond the Sword coverage is still continuing with that.
Still Beyond the Sword cast.
You should all probably know this, but Beyond the Sword is the biggest expansion for a Civ game ever released.
Really? I hadn't heard that yet.
In the news,
Civ Revolution has been announced.
All right.
Historical Civilization 4 Beyond the Sword scenarios overview.
Legal Civ 4 release goodies for China. And we have two Beyond the Sword previews. One, I think, in my opinion, is better than the other. In the modcast, we have Who is the Best Ally?
Just kidding.
Anyone?
What is your favorite leader's trait from CFC? Playing Morally, also a CFC thread. And in the Playing Morally, we have different examples of how to do that. So that'll be quite interesting. And a mythical best civilization, which in basically you create your own civ based on other civs that are existing.
In the Senate, we look at coastal cities better than landlocked. Is slavery essential? Religion, what's the best way to found one? And Shriner settled profit. And in the mailbag, we have feedback aplenty on episode 18 and responding to a question for one of the co-hosts.
Rise from a peasant. Fight as a warrior. Explore new lands. Lead your civilization. Become the greatest ruler the world has ever known.
The new console version of Civilization.
What do you think about that, Imran?
Well, I say why not? Let's bring the power of Civ to those on the consoles. Let them partake in the wonder and stuff.
I think you're going for something like the awe and majesty.
Oh, yes, the shock and awe.
Well, Sid said it's something he's always wanted to do. I don't know why he always wanted to do it, but for me it's one big meh.
Because they have a hot coffee version.
Ay.
Oh yeah, Catherine. Woo.
Imran has a point. I think it's dumbed down quite a bit for the console, to be quite brutally honest. It's for people that just want to dive into the game and don't want to sit there for hours thinking of strategies, and they just want to play the game and get over it and turn it off. I think that's pretty much what it is. Play games on the console. You play for half an hour, you turn it off. Nobody wants to sit there for 2-3 hours playing Civ. People don't have that attention spans for the console usually. It's a younger audience that's more into that sort of thing, in my opinion. But on the other hand, it's supposed to be incredibly immersive and very addictive game, so that's quite good.
Yeah, I see we're going to have, as it said in the press release, quote, revolutionary features like real-time interaction with leaders and advisors, extensive multiplayer capabilities, and integrated video and voice chat, unquote. Real-time interaction with leaders? Fraxis has invented time travel!
Yeah, I think that's more impressive than revolutions. Come on now.
Again, it's good for Sid to put something for the council for company reasons, financial reasons, and for just getting his name out there more with people that might not have a computer or know anything about Civ to begin with, and this might actually inspire them to somehow, in some way, get a computer and get, I'm not going to say real version, but the version everyone plays, and that is the Warlords and the upcoming Beyond the Sword and Civ 4 and maybe the previous games as well.
Well, we'll see.
Yep, slated for a release next spring, and the almost 2-minute trailer that was released, if you have a look at the very end of it, it shows you the logos of the platforms, or at least some of the platforms that Revolution will be on, and there's Xbox 360 and I believe PlayStation 3.
Yep, but the press release also talks of handhelds. Don't know which ones those will be.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting.
I guess we'll just take a wait-and-see attitude.
Yes, I'm not going to jump to any conclusions on this.
Exactly. This press release couldn't be more vague if they tried, so...
Oh, I don't know.
World-famous game designer Sid Meier brings the greatest strategy game of all time to the next generation. Sid Meier's Civilization Revolution.
IGN looks at the first 6 scenarios in the expansion. One of the first ones they go over is the Charlemagne scenario. Seems perhaps that the Charlemagne leader has been added because they had this nice beefy scenario. That's just my gloss on that, because the Holy Roman Empire as a Civ is pretty crap. But
yeah, let's not go there. But no, it seems more to me that it's the other way around. They want to add Charlemagne, and they also want to add a bunch of scenarios.
Mm.
I think the issue of the Holy Roman Empire is entirely separate from the issue of Charlemagne. Charlemagne itself is a good leader, so...
Well, it's true, but I guess that the Charlemagne scenario is the Frankish Empire is broken up, and it's up to the player to reunite the scattered pieces and claim the throne. You have a supply train unit, which is very interesting. You can't heal an enemy territory without the presence of a supply train unit. That's an interesting little wrinkle on the normal game.
I think the Holy Roman Empire Civ should have just been a mod in itself and left out of the main game.
I don't think it should have been in the game at all, but...
Now, the gods of old also sounds interesting. You can sacrifice great prophets to call down terrible disasters on enemy cities, which is kind of fun.
I have to say that having the new use for the great prophets and gods of old sounds most interesting because, as we discussed in a previous episode, after a very short while, great prophets are, well, meh, to be diplomatic. As a matter of fact, it would be nice to see that somehow make it into the regular game. Calling on modders.
The Inquisitor unit sounds interesting, too, in the Gods of Old. To eliminate any non-state religion.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
Nobody expects. Oh. And they also have Rays and Fall of Civilization, which I love and play all the time. Yeah.
So are these great prophet people, are they like nuclear bombs in a sense?
Well, they can send locusts.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
And meteors.
They can send disasters.
Oh, meteors.
Types.
And another one can prevent them.
Yep.
That's quite interesting. You know, in the main game, I don't see a real use for that, but for a mod, that's definitely quite interesting to have great prophet type as an attack unit as well.
Yeah, well, basically the way I see this, this is basically just a regular game. It's not a scenario. It plays like a mod. And the way I kind of see it, it's basically what they would have done with the religion model if political correctness wasn't an issue. I could see this happening with Christianity and Islam and stuff like that. It would be a bit politically incorrect, of course, and you couldn't do that for the main game. So, yeah, it's definitely an interesting variation.
Yes.
And it seems that we have 3 World War II scenarios. One for Pacific, one for Europe in 36, and one for Europe in 39.
Someone didn't listen to last week's show.
Yeah, because, you know, you weren't here. We talked about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I like to talk about World War II.
You should have been here when Dale was.
We do learn something new about the bitter winter events that simulate the hard winters of the Eastern Front, which Dale neglected to talk about.
That's why I didn't know what that was. Bitter winter, again, that's something that the more things you throw in the game that add depth to it, I will always agree with. I believe you always can't have too much stuff because, as Rich said in previous episodes, it just adds more detail, adds more options available to you to win the game. I know this has been covered already, but everything that Wouter said about Crossroads of the World in a previous episode, I completely agreed with, the Middle East scenario. Everyone wants to try different things, and I believe a Middle East scenario definitely needed to be done one way or the other. Apparently one of the ways to win is to get 30,000 gold.
Yeah. Kind of a disappointment to me, because that means it's basically the same scenario as Vikings in Warlords, that also had a gold requirement, and basically all you do in the game is collect as much gold as possible. And it's going to be a very linear strategy. You're entirely focused on gold and not on building an empire and all that other stuff. Basically anything that costs gold, you want to avoid. That was also kind of the problem with the Viking scenario.
And the Raider unit is explained now.
Yeah, that is an interesting new feature. They have provided some options that weren't available in the Viking scenario, such as the Raider units and the Guild Masters. So that could be interesting to play around with.
A Raider is basically like a land version of the Privateer.
Yep.
Provides a nice gold bonus.
Barbarians that you control.
When it pillages, it gets extra gold.
Yes, but for balance purposes, in order to actually conquer cities, you'll have to rely on more traditional units. Gosh darn it.
Yes, the defense scenario. There's random goody hats you can capture for a substantial cash
bonus.
Very
interesting little scenario as well.
Yeah, I love it on the screenshot. Number one threat to America, bears.
There's random goody huts scattered everywhere. Definitely people will be fighting over those, and they're substantially better than the main game goody huts.
Yet another important point about this scenario is the balance issue, where the units that are stacked together will be weakened proportional to the number of units in the stack. And also, since most of the units you buy, thanks to the advanced start system, are suited to combat in a particular type of tile, you'll need to arrange your forces wisely.
The stack thing is interesting because a lot of people now have complained they don't like the current stack system. They don't like you can have 50 units on one tile with no repercussions at all.
We do have catapults and other siege units in the main game. If you stack your units too highly, they do become a bit vulnerable to bombardment.
Yeah, it's interesting if you think about this new stack system and where you're going to have to really figure out who you want in your stack rather than just throwing units together.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. We'll see how it works out, of course.
Again, this is all conjecture until it comes out and is play tested by everybody.
Who can talk about it?
Exactly. No comment. Someone described this defense scenario, not in this article, but I think in the Phyrexis podcast, as sort of an arcade version of Civ. Because I've played it, and it does play very arcade-ish. It's a very fun, much very different kind of game. It's not really Civ.
That's definitely aimed toward the audience who really doesn't like the current Civ system, in my opinion. I could name names, but I'll be good.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to play around with that, that's for sure.
From the hills of medieval Europe to the farthest reaches of outer space, the scenarios of Beyond the Sword will take players to places they've never thought possible. Why not battle for the right to be named the next Holy Roman Emperor in Charlemagne, where guile, grace, and the brand new advanced start system will give players a previously impossible level of customization in their empire building and a chance to proclaim themselves ruler of all of Europe.
I think this next story is quite interesting for me. China is released Civ 4.
Legally.
Legally.
It comes with a statue and little box set, like a special edition, if you will. A little painted statue of, I guess, a bowman with real string. And it's supposed to be quite a beautiful statue and maybe a little incentive for people to buy it there. I think that's quite good for China to be doing this, honestly.
I want one.
Even if it's all your base belong to China version.
Yes.
That would be actually kind of neat, actually.
They said they had to take some things out of the game to make it workable for China. I'm not sure if that's for legal reasons or what. I'm not sure what they mean by that.
That means everyone gets neutered except for China, which gets everything.
Yeah.
And, of course, the
the equivalent price there of roughly $18 American for 139.
There's probably that price so people will actually buy it if it's too expensive. I'm sure nobody would get it. I'm not sure how popular Civ or Firaxis is in China. I'm too ignorant on that to comment anymore.
It is a neat statue, though.
Yeah, it's got a soundtrack CD with it, Tech Tree, a manual slimmed-down version from the original English version, because from Jason Bergman, who noted this on his blog, fully translated Chinese language manual would probably have been enormous.
I guess just the way the language translates, it would be enormous.
Although, if it is all your base belong to China version, I think the manual translated into the Chinese could be quite small as well.
Focusing on the modern era and beyond, the expansion adds a whole slew of new ways for players to rule the planet and brings back some old favorites. An expanded tech tree, an updated space race victory, and an early game United Nations-style wonder, known as the Apostolic Palace, are but a few of the new ways in which players can conquer the world of civilization.
I just want to get to the 1UP preview of Beyond the Sword first, because I thought it wasn't as good as the CVG one. I believe the CVG version covered a lot more territory than the 1UP one did. The reason I say that is because the 1UP version covers corporations in quite detail, talking about the corporate executives you can send into enemy territory. And pretty much all 1UP covered, to summarize, it was corporations. The CVG version covered 4 different aspects of the game, including spying, the space mod, corporations.
I'm looking at the CVG preview, and it doesn't seem like they've come up with anything that's different than the other previews that have just recently been released.
Oh, that's not true, Imran. There's a great opening anecdote.
Uh-oh.
That confused me at first. I wondered what exactly it was about until I actually read it.
Apparently this person decided the way to chat up some, as he said, pretty nurses was to embark on a solo discussion on exactly why Civ 4 suffered from not having a diplomat unit. Yep, that's
alright.
I didn't have to get my coat, it was handed to me.
What a great pickup line.
The space mod, I think, grabbed my attention more than anything on the CVG article. There's nice screenshots there. And the author even mentions Julius Caesar in a space outfit. That's got to be interesting.
No, he said he wanted him to be in it, but he was still wearing his toga.
Yeah.
A nice spacey screen.
I think he was Mackie in futuristic garb. It just wasn't what author wanted it to look like, but it was futuristic in some sort. I have no idea what he means by that. But
I think the 1UP article is notable for one thing, though. It was reportedly written by a woman.
I don't want to like get bad emails from the 1UP people if they hear this, so I just want to say that it was a good article, well written. It just didn't cover as much information as the other one did. That's all I meant.
Ian, I think you're safe on that.
Yeah, I don't think the 1UP people
or anyone else for that matter.
Yeah.
I've just learned to cover my tracks recently here, so.
You don't need to cover your tracks. I've said crap since this thing began, and no one's even sent me a hate email.
One thing on the computer and video games article, it had an interesting quote at the end. I've never thought about Civ in this way, and I'm not sure when I read it over and I think about it whether I want to think about Civ in this way. But in talking about Beyond the Sword being released, the Squill Porter guy on CVG says, "The mother penguin of Firaxis effortlessly spewing the finest of gaming fish guts into the clamoring open mouths of its fans and floating voters alike." I think someone needs some sleep.
Yeah.
Would it be less drunk?
Yeah.
But he does say, "I'm going to tell every stranger I meet about it, even the sexy ones. Social exclusion be damned, and Sid Meier be praised." Well,
he's got the latter part right.
You'll have a lot of time to play Civ, because I think you're staying single.
Got news? Email news@apolton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Locutus, Illuminatus, Snoopy369, or Grand Patrol via Polton's forums at apolton.net/forums.
Modcast time?
Yep.
Yay! Woo!
And welcome to the Modcast, where we talk about various hot topics on all the different forums that talk about Civ.
Who is the best ally? One of my good friends, Alexander I, started this thread. Nobody was really very consistent as to who was the best ally, unless you went through and wrote everything down or had a good memory. But in my experience anyway, Huanya Capac has always been good to me. I know a lot of people complain about him. Every time he's in the game, he makes an awesome ally. He's financial, so he has a decent economy to help you out with. He's always good in the tech race. He's aggressive, so he's good in a battle, and he'll back you up if you offer him to help you. So whenever he's in the game, I always ally with him immediately. I think he's one of the best to ally with.
So when Civilization Revolution comes out and you get a chance to interact with him directly, are you going to let him know what you've nicknamed him? Do you think he'll like that?
Ah, so you read that, huh?
Yes.
He reads everything.
Imran, who's your favorite ally?
Mansa Musa. He's a nice little guy. He's never stabbed me in the back, so I like him.
Mansa is always hated on by everybody else, in my opinion. He's always getting beat up on. I don't know if everyone's noticed, but there's usually two different groups of civs. You have the aggressive civs, like Huanya Capac, for example, or Napoleon, and then you have the other, like Abraham Lincoln, Gandhi-type civs that always go together. All the aggressive civs will always be friendly with each other, unless they have different religions.
Damn religions.
The aggressive civs make the best allies. They're better in a war, and they're always first to go in a war, and if you ally with the aggressive civs in the war, you can eliminate the weaker civs and give yourself a better chance of winning.
And I suppose there's also the argument, I believe, that was put forth that nobody else is going to be friends with them, so they're looking for friends.
Friends.
Or suckers, depending on your difficulty level.
Dan, who is your favorite ally?
I actually put together a top five.
The World Builder.
World Builder.
Top five.
I was going to say that.
Actually, I put Cyrus for the reasons that Alexander the First cites as number one. Mansa Musa for number two, where Silver mentions probably the fastest researcher around, willing, always willing to trade. I noticed that, too. He really goes crazy on the text.
Yeah, yes. That's why I picked him, too. I got yelled at for it.
Saladin at number three, as long as we have the same religion. Osaka at number four. Ian also mentioned Gandhi. And like Pinchak has experienced, he never seems to backstab. Although, again, I guess Pinchak and I probably should disclose, but level of difficulty we're on. I don't know. He's probably higher than I am, anyway. And I'd give an honorable mention to Washington as well. But definitely Cyrus number one, but Mansa Musa is a pretty close second.
And Dan, all those civs you mentioned are all in the same group?
Yes.
Friendly group.
Oh, was there something else?
Friendly group. All we are saying.
Give friendly groups a chance. What?
Hi.
And Mackie, who do you like to ally with?
I get Cyrus in my games a lot for some reason, so I've allied with him quite a few times. I actually don't usually ally with Mansa Musa because I'm usually trying to out-tech him. I don't want to trade to him and help him get ahead.
Yes, he's quite dangerous if he gets ahead.
Yes. I think in my games it usually tends to depend on the religion more than anything, because the ones who are sharing your religion are more likely to ally with you, even regardless of whether they're the more aggressive type or the more friendly type. Although, of course, there's always consistently Montezuma stabbing you in the back, but...
Yes.
Damn him.
Huh? Yes, I thought that was just a myth that he would attack you when he's friendly, but it happened to me, so I know that definitely is true.
It's not a myth.
For me, the best ally is always whoever is second closest to me. I kill whoever is closest to me and ally whoever is second closest, and then make sure I spread my religion to them, so... I don't really care who, if it's Cyrus or Mansa or whatever.
Well, it's a good thing this is your strategy in-game only, because, I have a favorite quote in this thread.
Ooh, favorite quote.
Oh, I have to hear this.
Favorite quote from Jack Rudd. If you make Tokugawa your ally, the world will marvel at your awesomeness and you will win the game easily.
Yeah, the trick there would be making Tokugawa your ally.
Yeah.
Easier said than done.
Yes, I agree totally. He's extremely difficult for some reason to make friends with.
Has he ever smiled?
No.
That's his problem. He needs to smile more.
Corporations, similar to religions for the late game, allow players to make money, spread goods among their cities, and battle their opponents for precious natural resources.
Our second modcast topic is, what is your favorite leader's trait? By Civ Manu the Seventh. The number one trait on CFC was financial, believe it or not.
Gee, I never guessed.
But I disagree. I do not think financial is the best trait. I think creative is, because I always struggle getting a religion, and if you are creative, your culture will expand quicker than your little monuments will allow, and you will really catch up to the other civs that have a religion, and the only deficit you will have will be in the happiness department, in which case you can just get theaters quickly enough, and then you pretty much don't need a religion until you get either one of the later ones like Christianity, Islam, Taoism, or perhaps Confucianism, which is what I go for usually.
Yeah, I cast my vote for creative too.
Yes, it's just the culture is just too much to ignore.
Number three on that list is industrious.
Yeah, it used to be a lot better, but...
Yeah, I don't really get that.
I can still see why that's good.
Yeah, it kind of got the nerf bat.
Just a bit.
Well, with industrious, for people that are wonder crazy, I don't see how you would not want to be industrious.
That's true, but you don't really need many wonders to actually win the game. They're nice, of course, but they're not necessary.
I totally agree. I've never been big on wonders.
Now, why aren't the warlord ones included in this?
That's a good question. The only ones he mentions are vanilla.
And you know we all like chocolate.
No. The warlord is the strawberry, and beyond the sword is going to be the chocolate. Get it straight.
I think creative is still the best out of all of them.
Well, I have to go for financial. It's a lot more flexible. That extra commerce you can use for science, you can use for culture, for whatever you want. But creative is definitely the second best. The best combo is, for me, is financial and creative.
Well, you talked about what is your favorite leader's trait. What is everyone's least favorite?
Ooh.
Well, it seems to me that spiritual is basically useless. Not basically useless, but...
Tends to encourage me to settler spam too much, and that usually is where I need financial.
Realistic is definitely the weakest, in my opinion.
Okay, and if we were just going to strictly to vanilla traits?
Strictly vanilla? I've never been expansive. I can see how it would help know other people, but I've never ever saw the need to be expansive.
Well, expansive, I suppose if you were stuck in a whole bunch of jungle, you might be.
Yeah, expansive has its uses.
It's
not extremely powerful, but it does help
to
go fast and early game.
As compared to the other ones, though, I don't think it's as good.
I'd put organized at the bottom.
Organized is good for the courthouses, especially in my strategy. I love to rex, and the courthouses for me is a necessity, but it's definitely not my favorite.
Civic upkeep being reduced is nice for money.
Yeah, it's not bad. It's not extremely powerful, but it's certainly not bad, especially if you want to run some of the later civics. If you combine it with, is it the pyramids that give free civics?
Yes, just the government.
All free government civics?
Yeah.
And then the other sword will have another wonder. One of the new wonders gives all religion civics for free.
A combination of those two is quite dangerous.
Yeah, exactly. And especially if you're organized, and that means you can actually afford to run late game civics.
I know that in the New World Wonders, the Crystal Renditor apparently allows the players to switch civics without anarchy. In that case, it just makes spiritual even more useless, doesn't it?
Yes.
I mean, not everyone gets the wonder.
There are two things. Spiritual can get it twice as fast, and it also eliminates the need to wait four turns before you switch civics again.
Mm-hmm.
So you can switch to four times a turn. Could be quite useful.
And for those feeling a little underhanded, the espionage system in Beyond the Sword lets players sneak on an epic scale, allowing them to engage in ferocious covert activities.
Well, that really does lead us into our next topic, and it's how you play the game. It's not really a Senate topic, but it's more playing morally. Thousand Young from CFC made this thread. An example of playing morally is playing without no slavery, no slavery whip, emancipation as quickly as possible, which I think is one of the worst civics in the game, but playing without backstabbing anybody or pillaging, raising cities, playing like you are, you know, a true heroic, firing leader that people will look up to.
Yeah, meh. And heroism is overrated.
He's an evil overlord.
Exactly.
It's a game. Whatever.
I'm going to kill and maim and plunder.
And besides, the time of when you get slavery, slavery was around all over the place. It was moral at the time. So therefore...
Exactly.
Yeah. I don't care.
Well, it took me a long time to even want to use slavery, just because in previous Civs I hadn't really used it, but it's really powerful in Civ 4.
Mm.
It took me playing a scenario type thing that somebody else set up to me to see how powerful that was, and that it's actually a good tool, and sort of get my head past the idea that, oh my god, slavery, I can't do this to people.
An example of playing morally is a nonviolent Gandhi type strategy, in which it's actually an article, if you will, in which the user plays as Gandhi, playing the game without any military units at all.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Hylerion, Monarch, a normal speed, standard size, Pangea map. He had six opponents, Catherine Victoria, Cyrus Washington, Peter and Mansa Musa, and he did win a diplomatic victory in 1856. He says, it looks like stable relationships can be made with the AI, at least with those I had to face in this game, which I think we can relate to who's your favorite ally, because we have Cyrus on that list, and Washington, and Mansa Musa.
Yes.
Yeah, he didn't have a real warmonger on there.
They're all the same group, yes. He must have been playing without barbarians, because if he was playing with barbs, he would have been wiped out before AD.
Yeah.
We actually touched upon a bit this in Episode 7 with Mackie, myself, and Dolphin again. Jeez, for mentioning him. And I indicated that I supported, if you're in the early game and the higher difficulty levels and you're being threatened, slavery was extremely important. Dolphin notes it's a good form of population control as well, which some people said it was great to whip those unhappy people to death.
Exactly.
We mentioned that.
Yes, that's a good strategy.
At the same time, I think a lot of people are getting hung up on whipping because of your moral concerns about whipping. We mentioned in the past about it being completely acceptable and the difficulty of applying our present-day attitudes to times which we did not live in and did not experience. And we've also talked about in the past about how, oh, Civ should be more like reality. And then we talk about, well, when it's reality versus gameplay and fun, sometimes they don't match. So since Civ is not always based in reality, and in many respects it's not, what we would consider moral in real life should not necessarily equate what we consider moral in the game. Unless you like losing on higher difficulty levels. You like that?
I totally agree.
In a modern era thing, I did in the first Civ, but I haven't since then. I never use nukes. I know they're really powerful, but I just can't do it. I mean, maybe that's just me. Maybe because I grew up through Reagan and the Cold War era, but I can't do it. I think I've seen War Games or something too many times. It's scary to me.
I think nukes are too darn expensive. I'd rather build something else than take all that time to build a nuke, which I'd probably just sit in my city anyway.
Well, then you'll be happy with the introduction of ICBMs and beyond the sort. Then you'll have another option other than nukes.
Yay. The next thing here is quite interesting. It's another example of how to play morally. I think it's better than the Gandhi example. It's called the Honorable French. And there's actually 12 different rules you have to play by here. Some of them are you're allowed to sign defensive pacts, but every civ has a right to defend itself, but you're not allowed to be police state, a vassalage, a theocracy. You must adopt emancipation and stay there. If a friendly civ requests your aid, you can join them. You may not choose to raise any cities. Giving away cities is only honorable if they are given to an ally who owned them when the war began. You must do all in your power to feed the people. No starvation, that means also no slavery. And it just goes on and on, different examples, like no pillaging, your spies don't want to do counter-espionage. It's basically rules how to play morally, and you have to stay by it the whole game.
Yeah, there was that list, and which I think for the, you know, the purpose of game, that's fine, and that's a different way to try to play. But, of course, some of those, again, on the higher difficulty levels, you might be saying, well, it might be easier to do that in a multiplayer game if everyone agreed to that, as opposed to with the AI, because it might be difficult to communicate that to the AI. Another list that another user posted, based on international law, as he says, propagated by the United Nations, but he talks about there being some very similar points about switching to all UN global civics when possible, not just emancipation, for instance, with you also got no city raising, no pillaging of improvements except strategic resources and roads, which was odd. No attacking workers and settlers. Must not build Manhattan Project. My least favorite one, however, is no inciting wars between third parties. Oh man. Whereas trade embargoes and closed borders are okay. Both lists are very similar, but I think what Ian was mentioning in terms of the honorable French, I think that's a little more fleshed out and a little more specific to the game, but at the same time, it's not something that I would play with consistently. Probably because I couldn't remember all these rules.
Yes, I don't think I'd ever play this way.
Kind of boring to me.
Yeah.
No war, no diplomacy, what on hell can you do?
This thing makes me mad.
You're just sitting there clicking next turn, next turn, next turn.
I'm going to start whipping people in my next game just because I'm pissed at this suggestion.
Along with a greatly enhanced AI and a brand new random event system, Beyond the Sword dramatically ramps up the epic game of Civilization IV.
a mythical best civilization. I'm sure we've all wanted to give our take on this here. And you have to name your...
The Dutch.
You have to name your favorite traits, your favorite unit, your favorite unique building, and your favorite starting text. Two of them, of course. And you put them together and make your own civ.
The Dutch, well, now, Wouter, the Dutch aren't going to be mythical come beyond the sword. They're actually going to exist yet.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're pretty damn powerful, if you ask me. They might have a more powerful unique unit, but they have my favorite traits, my favorite building. Pretty good unit. Might want to replace that with a legionary, but other than that, I'm not sure what the starting techs are. I'm pretty much a Dutch. And no, that's not a nationalistic thing. Although it happens to work out quite nicely.
And Wetter had absolutely no influence in
that. Actually, I didn't. Surprisingly, the Dutch are always overpowered in many games. Colonization, and Rise of Nations, Age of Kings.
My favorite mythical best was my favorite two traits are creative and organized, just like Augustus Caesar, I believe, has those traits. My favorite unit is the Impi, believe it or not. I liked Impi from the previous Civ games because it can replace a horseman in a sense because it moves quick. You can give him attack promotions. He doesn't have to be a defender. My favorite building is the Salon from the French. I love it from the Free Artist. I believe that's, you can't pass that up. Having a free great person is just incredible. That's awesome. And my favorite two traits are hunting and agriculture. I believe bronze working is overrated. I know I'm probably going to get flamed or whatever for this, but it's true. I don't agree with the whole whip strategy. By the time you get bronze metal, you can't really utilize it in the early game for wars anyway. It's only useful against barbs, and my archers are quite good against axemen anyway. I usually get iron working anyway later, and if I have bronze, good, but iron's a better metal because you can allow for better units than bronze allows. In my opinion, bronze is only good for slavery, and I don't like killing off my population.
It's also good for MP.
Yeah. On the higher difficulty levels.
Yeah, I play on Prince, so that's pretty moderate. Agriculture is good because pottery is my favorite early tech because of cottages, and the agriculture just leads you to that, and as well, if I build a worker, which I build workers quickly, it gives something to do quickly instead of just sitting there waiting.
My starting techs, I have to say mining, because it leads to bronze working. If you play on a higher difficulty level or an MP, you really can't do without whipping and without chopping. And of course, the bronze is also very important. You want to get that online as fast as possible. And the wheel, because whatever resources you have around your cities, you're going to need roads. So you might as well have that one. You always need roads.
Traits, creative as well, and being world type builder that I am, someone who plays on Warlord level, and liking the culture bomb, I do like Industrious. Oh, geez, maybe I'll get some hate mail now. Starting technologies, I definitely go with the wheel as well, for the reasons Wetter said, but I would also go with mysticism, because I am looking to found a religion as soon as possible, and we discussed in previous episodes, and just as a brief aside, that's towards Judaism, because I'm sick and tired of trying to go for Hinduism and Buddhism and getting to one or two turns away from it, and someone else founds it first.
Calm down, Dan. It's okay.
I'm good now.
Take a breath. Breathe. Breathe.
But, of course, with Beyond the Sword coming out, all of this may change ever so slightly. Time will tell. But my unique unit would be a war chariot, but with an attack bonus against archers. And a unique building, I would really love a monument that does not expire.
Wouldn't we all?
I guess for the traits, I think the whole combination of financial and creative for the unique unit, I like the Praetorian. You know, they're just kind of fun.
Who doesn't love the Praetorians?
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, come on now. What else am I going to say? I don't know if I necessarily have a favorite unique building, because, well, I don't think I play enough Civs to know.
Exactly.
But the starting text, I mean, I agree with the wheel, but also kind of like something like mining to be early on.
I know bronze working is very popular. I'm more for archery myself. It's just personal taste.
The thing is, you don't need archery really early on.
Yeah, you don't need axemen early either.
No, but you can't get it early either. You still have to research bronze working and hook up your bronze. The sooner you get started on that, the better.
Bronze working is best, I think, for chopping down trees.
Exactly, that's also important.
That's the only reason I really get it.
From bronze working, it's one step to iron working. You need that for cutting down jungle and for indeed even stronger units.
No, I have to go with creative and either financial or organized, because either one can help with building a bigger empire, because I tend to mess up on the economy, as we know. I need something to help me.
You're conflicted about what your second trait would be.
Yeah. Well, either one of those works for me.
Did you ever have to make up your mind?
She's a woman. Of course she didn't have to.
Right. I can change any time I want as well.
Shall we move to the Senate?
Welcome to the Senate. In this section, we talk about game strategy.
Let's start with the coastal city. I think you need both. It's not necessarily better, but I mean, it's not smart to just be landlocked, or you miss out on all that fun little commerce that you get when you plop down a coastal city, and you can build some navies and do a little bit more fun exploring. And those trade routes, I guess, is the main reason that you would want some coastal cities. I'm not sure if they're necessarily better than landlocked, but I think you need a mix of balance. If you just have landlocked ones and get by, but you're missing out on a whole hell of a lot of commerce and some sort of navy type of thing.
Well, the AA doesn't know how to use the navy, so that's no problem.
Yeah, actually, CFC user Fluke, who started this, says that he likes to build cities on the coast because he thinks it gives them a lot of protection early to mid-game. And, yeah, the protection argument, I think that's more validity in single-player games when the AI doesn't necessarily know what it's doing, although we may have to revisit this come Beyond the Sword.
As I'm used to doing, I will play devil's advocate here and say that I like landlocked better in the case that, yes, I want to see the coast, but if your capital is near the coast and you expand inland quite a bit, and presuming you're on a big continent map, which is more popular usually, depending, the maintenance costs are going to be killing you because your capital is over here and your city spread halfway across the map this way, and then you have to move your palace. And if you're landlocked, you can do a strategy I like to call honeycombing, in which case you spread your cities in a circular pattern around your main one. You're more centralized as far as the maintenance costs. You can always move your capital no matter what the map. I've never done that before, honestly. But in this case, I think landlocked is better than coastal. I believe coast is important. But if you're more centralized, like I'm just going to say again, the maintenance cost is less damaging.
Yeah, I would agree with you. If you know, for example, that you are stuck on an island, you may want a coastal city. Or if you're playing a one-city challenge, I think you're better off to have a coastal city, for reasons Imran mentioned, for commerce and having access to the sea. We mentioned about single-player versus multiplayer games, also difficulty-level considerations. And at the same time, you mentioned, Ian, about being able to move your capital at any time. I think if you come across coast and you have some food resources such as crab, fish, clam, you may want to consider doing that to help your city grow more quickly. But yes, I would agree, generally speaking, you're better off not to have a coastal city as your first city. But unless you're unless you're playing on a Pangaea or something equivalent, you do want a coastal city as soon as possible.
Well, if you're financial, you want to have the coast cities because of the extra gold on the tile.
Well, nobody plays with that trait, so we're good.
Well, for those of us that do.
I think Wouter, being the Dutch, will definitely want to be coastal.
Yeah, the thing is, the basically two things that are really important, two resources, it's commerce and production. Food only as useful to get in the long run more gold and more production. Production, the more cities you have, the more production you need to build your libraries and your granaries, and a lot of it more or less goes to waste. The more commerce you have, most of that goes immediately to your research. So I think commerce is the most valuable resource in the game of the three main resources. So the more you have of that, the better. Therefore, I think coastal cities are generally a little bit better than landlocked, but of course, you can't win the game without a couple of decent production cities as well.
Players can rule an outer space empire in Final Frontier, with over a dozen new units, a unique tech tree, and a vast interstellar battlefield.
I think we've pretty much covered our next topic already, that's about slavery. Is it essential? Everyone pretty much agrees it is.
I think you could play without it, but you really have to optimize your strategy specifically for it. One of the main issues with slavery is also, what other civic are you going to use? Because none of the other civics in the same category are particularly powerful.
I agree.
So you might as well. Maybe if, I don't know, the worker serfdom would give you a 100% bonus for works instead of 50%, maybe that would become a little bit more interesting or something like that.
I agree. Whipping is very powerful, especially multiplayer games. Needing that building very quickly, time constraints and different factors, whipping is extremely important in that case.
I do believe there are other valid strategies, but yeah, it's hard to beat the whipping.
And in addition to difficulty level, it works better earlier on in the game when your city sizes are still small because it takes less time to...
Yes.
There was an interesting related question in this thread on Slavery Central from Captain Kill over at CFC. The thread was started by Anykeys. If you agree to slavery being used at some point, when do you stop using it, or do you stop using it?
I stop using it myself. I like serfdom better, but that's just me.
Same here, actually.
You have to at some point. Like you were saying, it's harder to grow back the population later, and you need the larger cities so you can have more child work, and you have more production and more commerce.
Eventually, you need to quit it, yeah. But there's not really a predefined point at that tech.
Yeah.
When your cities reach a certain size, I don't even have a specific size in mind for that, but when they start getting larger, you do want to keep that growth going to collect more commerce and more regular hammers in the long run.
Well, the reason we're hung up on whipping is because Dan finds that titillating.
Or command your very own squadron of Gravebringers through herds of nightmarish creatures in Afterworld, the first tactical squad-based mod built in the Civ 4 engine.
The next one is about religion. What's the best way to found one? Of course, the best way is to start with mysticism.
Yeah, that can help.
I pretty much agree with the user in this thread, Vind. He says, starting with mysticism, researching polytheism out of the gate is probably the best possible strategy to take you if you want to be sure to found a religion. The odds of getting Hinduism are very good. I agree. I never go for Buddhism first. I go for Hinduism because I assume everyone's going for Buddhism because it's cheaper.
Yeah, me too. Almost always works too, so...
He also offers an interesting strategy here. If you fail to establish Buddhism or Hinduism, a good follow-up is to research priesthood and then start on the oracle. Research to writing while you build it, and then you can take Code of Laws for your free tech and establish Confucianism.
Yeah, that's often how I go about it, actually. If I don't start with mysticism, I don't bother with the early religions, but I definitely want to get an oracle so I can get courthouses and a religion that's associated with it, Confucianism. If you don't start with mysticism, you don't even have to bother with an early religion.
Imran, what's the way you go about getting a religion? Do you go for a religion?
If it happens, it happens. I play a very free-flowing style of Civ.
You don't have strategies then?
Strategy? What? Huh?
Strategy?
Dan, did anything in this thread stand out for you?
There's one thing that stuck out in my mind, and that was from Getting Fat's recommendations. Everyone's talking about what's the best way to found a religion. He says, just let your neighbor found them and then take their holy cities.
Yeah, that's definitely a good
one. That one works quite well.
That's the alternative approach. I've been known to do that. The Oracle is the only one that's really high on my list, and Stonehenge if I can get it. But the other ones are just as easy to just conquer.
It only works if you're the aggressive sort. If you're the builder sort, I don't know if that necessarily is good advice.
My recommendation would be hope for Hinduism, but count on Judaism. If you research polytheism, that puts monotheism next in line to research. And again, if you're the first to it, Judaism. I cannot think of an instance where I was going to found Judaism and someone beat me to it. That wasn't enough. With monotheism, the organized religion civic that becomes available with it is one of the better civics you'll come across in the game as far as I'm concerned, and it can be obtainable damned early. And a lot of people talk about, well, oh, if we don't get an early religion, I'm going to be in trouble culturally, and that's true. So a lot of people will go for Hinduism or Buddhism, and hadn't thought about going for Confucianism by getting the Oracle and then getting the free technology. But again, if you're not a wonder builder, or just looking straight at the technology line, Judaism is not that far behind from Hinduism and Buddhism. Besides, most AIs, and some are more the human players too, perhaps, again, will go for meditation and Hinduism. But I think if you're still stuck and you don't have Hinduism, Judaism, or Buddhism, go for Christianity, because sure enough, monotheism has opened up theology, which will award the first civ who researches it. And then I would say Confucianism would be your next best, followed by Taoism, and lastly available Islam. And of course, everything that I'm saying here, and a lot of what we've said about which specific religion is going to change post Beyond the Sword, seeing as how you'll have the option which one to choose, but it'll still be technology dependent, so just put the names here, won't be quite so hard and fast.
I think that's a great feature.
And if you get beat to all three early ones, and you also don't get the oracle, if you built Stonehenge, you still have another way of getting religion. Because the first great prophet, you could use the light bulb one of them.
Very true, yes.
Yeah, that's true.
Ah, yes.
The problem with going from monotheism and Judaism is that you need masonry for that, and that's not a particularly important tech in itself. And in the meantime, instead, you could just be researching writing and combine writing with priesthood, and you have Confucianism. Assuming you can get the oracle, of course, but pretty much always get that.
That's what Vind mentions. He says, an alternative strategy, which has been mentioned by Dan, is to just forget about the oracle and just get Stonehenge. You'll get your great potfit. You can use that to establish Christianity, so, and get that organized religion.
Yeah, that's an alternate strategy. I hadn't thought of that yet. Judaism, I don't really see the point. I mean, you're researching a couple of texts that you don't really urgently need, so that's just a waste of time, in my opinion. The Christianity path and the oracle path, those are both quite interesting.
Or pry back the icy fingers of the God of Winter in Fall from Heaven, Age of Ice, the latest in the Fall from Heaven series, the number one fan-created mod for Civilization IV, available exclusively in Beyond the Sword.
Our next topic actually is a fairly easy one, I think. Shrine or Settled Prophet. Who would not pick a shrine over a Settled Prophet? I'd like to hear an argument for the Settled Prophet, if anyone has one.
Yeah, no. Between a shrine and a settled prophet, that's a no-brainer. I'm not sure why there's even a thread about this.
Well, if you're at the point in the game where you've already settled all the shrines that you've got, but you're not planning on conquering everybody else to get their holy cities to put shrines in,
then
you probably settle them.
Not planning to do that.
Yeah, so.
I suppose if you hadn't had the opportunity to found a religion and you've adopted a religion of someone else and you're planning on sticking with that religion for a good time and you want to help promote that religion, then you might take your great prophet and set the shrine in that religion has been founded. But at the same time, I think you'd probably be better off direct benefits and more measurable benefits to, in that case, settle the prophet.
Yeah,
that's
just
true.
Build your own missionaries.
And I honestly don't know what else to say about the whole shrine settle the prophet other than I always build the shrine first. I often get my temples as quickly as possible so I can build my great prophet, so I'm allowed a way to get my great prophet as far as specialist citizens. I don't have Stonehenge, that is.
I guess one situation in which made settled prophet is better is if you only have a few cities and there's no one near you that you can spread your religion to. In that case, you may only get a handful of gold from your shrine, and a settled prophet gives +2 damage, which is always nice. But also +5 gold, and that gets multiplied by all sorts of multipliers. You could easily get 10 or 15 gold towards somewhat later in the game. On a small map, I could see it paying off, or if you have very few civs, otherwise not.
If you capture a holy city and they didn't build their shrine yet, and your religion is so powerful in that case, I would not build a second shrine for that religion if I'm not going to use it, if I don't want it to spread.
Exactly.
And in that case, yes, I would pick my settled prophet.
But for your primary religion, you pretty much always want to have a shrine, I think.
I suppose you might want to spread that other religion in the hopes that it would get to your cities, because even if you're not planning on adopting that other religion, it does open up the opportunity to build temples, etc. up the line, and that could increase your gold.
One thing that makes me or Dan feel better is someone asked, how do you build a great prophet in the thread? I feel like an expert now.
That's the whole reason for temples early on, is so you can build your great prophet, I think. As far as culture is great, the great prophet's extremely more important than that, so you can get your shrine.
Yeah, I always go for Stonehenge, if I can. That pretty much guarantees that you get a great prophet sooner or later, usually sooner.
Never before has an expansion pack provided so much to so many in one package. Sid Meier's Civilization IV Beyond the Sword. It's beyond anything you've ever seen in Civ, and it's coming to a store near you, July 2007.
Mailbag, thank you, Imran. I'm missing that.
For the first time, I saw some CFC comments about the mailbag, which Locatus very friendly handed over some comments in one of their threads.
Yeah, speaking of Wetter, Wetter has a comment from episode 18 to respond to. Why don't you go for that now?
Huh? What?
Am I going to have to send you the link? My goodness sakes, it was about your comment on pacifism. There you go. And it was actually Memphis who noticed later, hey, there's more than just Dale's interview. I listened to it twice. There's a whole other show. Which is awesome.
Uh-oh. They made horrible comments about us, too. Llama Cat, the woman, whose name is Maka, knows plenty about the game in general. So why don't you sit on a, well... unpleasant broom handle and spin.
Lucky I didn't see that comment, or there would have been some hell to pay.
I didn't see that comment either.
Well, what the heck? On post 31 for Polycast 18, that woman speaking with the Polycast doesn't seem to understand the game in general. She keeps making stupid statements when they're talking about unique units and buildings. I haven't noticed anything stupid about Mikey's comments, and I've listened to most of the episodes.
What? You have? When did that happen?
At least somebody's defending me.
That was Will Nine, post number 33 in that topic. I read these right now, and I know more about them than you do. What the hell?
I think Will Nine's looking for a date.
What, you mean with Dan? That's not the way to go about getting it.
Oh my word. I don't know why that person is so down on Mackie.
Boo to you.
Boo.
They're just jealous.
Yeah.
You're lucky I'm retired, you nasty person.
I was very tempted to post, let's set up a one-on-one game. I want to see who's better. I'm pretty sure he's going to get his ass kicked.
Oh, Voider, you almost got away with it. What's your response to Will Nine about pacifism?
He could have had an even bigger army without pacifism.
That works.
We've also gained new listener, Matos, who apparently was looking forward to getting home and listening to episode 19 last time.
He says, oh, the episode was really good. I had to get used to the more relaxed environment. I was expecting a more professional show, but I guess since it's a group of gamers, that was...
Yeah. You're clearly the voice.
That was still the expectation.
Professionals, what?
What? Yeah.
Huh?
And so then someone said, this is a poll.
I think that was Lucutus.
No, it wasn't me, but it could have been.
Oh, no, it was someone else from Polygon.
Oh, I think it was Newgog who said
Newgog.
The posting of episode 19, less than 24 hours since we're recording this. I did post about it on CFC, and I actually included a poll on CFC that mirrors the one on Poulton, and the tendency to get about half of the votes to be one atrocious just kind of migrated over.
Well, right now, it seems 37% have given it a 1. 25% have given it a 6, 25% have given it a 7, and 12.5% have given it an 8.
So we were at about a 7, basically.
Yes.
Yeah. This one does not go to 11.
No.
Oh, only Mackie seemed to get that. Oh, well.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-659, 301-637-POLLY.
And for Europe, 44-020-7871-7659, 44-020-7871-POLLY.
Or you can Skype us at the Polycast.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the official Polycast website at polycast.apolton.net.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Polycast. We hope that you have not fallen asleep during the playback of this episode. Or if you have, thanks for clicking on it in the first place. I am Imran Siddiqui, Imran Siddiqui on the forums, though I will deny it to my dying day. I'm joined by Dan Q, Dan Quick.
Hello.
Hello, Makula. I don't know her real name.
Goodbye.
The cutest, Uter Snyders.
Again, you get it wrong.
Flatter Snyders.
That's better.
I like saying woo.
Maybe by the time we get to episode 50 or so, he'll have it down.
Well, it's because there's the .com gets in my head. Mm-hmm. You've never been on .com, have you?
No.
Oh.
And on your recommendation, he never will.
No, it's a thing. Anyway, and our guest co-host, Ian Hodges. Oz.
I need to say one last thing that I think I'm famous for.
Uh-oh.
Peace.
Peace.
Huh? Pea soup? What?
Peace.
Well, thank you for joining us. I hope we have not wasted too much of your time. I haven't said anything that leads to me getting hate mail, so I better do it now. We totally destroy and Mac user suck. Peace out.
There you go.
Okay.
Mac users have to wait for it all episode, but there it is.
There it is. I kid the Mac users, even though they overpay for a piece of crap. What? Where did that come from?
Let's give them something to talk about. How about Steve? Steve?
Okay. No, it's the same. Polycast rule. No singing.
Recorded date July 7th, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization 4 and its Warlords Expansion Pack. Civilization Revolution and its BTS trailer clips. Copyright 2K Games. Copyright 2007, Apolton Civilization site at apolton.net.